Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is a colleague from the University of Chicago, Robert Pippin, who's a much accomplished scholar, philosopher by training, and he is, of course, appointed in that department at the university, but also at the Committee on Social Thought, a distinctive organization at the University of Chicago. And he's done much serious scholarly writing on the great Western philosophers. Particularly, he's focused on Kant and on Nietzsche. But he's got a strange hobby, shall we call it?
Okay. You could call it a hobby. I think it's more serious than that, but yeah, sure.
You are a cineast, at least.
Yeah, right. But I'm not a member of the film studies department, so I guess it has to be called a hobby.
But you've been studying lots of films.
For years and years, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
And a newest book, you just handed it to me tonight, I've not yet read it, is titled Realism in American Film Noir, Some Cinematic Philosophy. Mm-hmm. But it follows upon the book that we are going to be discussing tonight, mm-hmm. which is quite similar, but it does the same job on the American Western. Mm-hmm. And this book is titled Hollywood Westerns and American Myth. Would you agree with me when, and I draw here from the book of Matthew, chapter 7, verse 16, I discover, by their fruits shall you know them. Mm-hmm. Transpose that or alter that just a bit. By their works shall you know them, mm-hmm. and by their art shall you know them. And not just the artist, but those who consume the art. When it comes to popular arts, like movies, mm-hmm. or you could have spoken of the theater earlier, or just popular novels and so on, the kinds that really succeed and that people really go for in a big way tell you something about those people, not merely as individuals, but maybe something about the culture and the way it works, the culture in which those films, in this case, were produced and are so positively received yeah. by large audiences. Surely that was always true of the best Westerns.
Yeah, that's especially true of these famous Hollywood genre films in the 30s, 40s, and 50s mm-hmm. when the studio system was in effect. And Hollywood churned out a number of films that had a kind of basic plot structure and a basic kind of characterization that was expanded and replayed and invented upon in a number of different ways. But it was you could call it a sort of basic form of understanding. The war film, for example, was a basic way in which filmmakers wanted to both express and vary how human beings understood what war
was. Most of the guys in the war were gung-ho. They were ready to do their duty, but either Jimmy Cagney or else some other character was rebellious and didn't really believe in the war and made a lot of trouble, but by the end of the film, he had come to understand.
That was one variety. Most of them were kind of egalitarian, democratic films, mm-hmm. a bunch of people from across the country, from different areas of the country.
Brooklyn, always the Italian and the Jew and the Negro and so on.
And people from different social classes. And yeah, by the Korean War, also blacks. But yeah. not until the Korean War. But then some great task had a kind of leveling effect, and an egalitarian ethos emerged, and they became one fighting unit that then succeeded in the task, and it was a kind of education in the egalitarian nature of American
society. Now come to the Western. What is the prototypical structure of the truly successful Western in the classic period?
Yeah. There are a number of types, but the most important Western was the Western about the bringing of civilization and law to an essentially lawless society. Mm-hmm. That's quite interesting philosophically because a number of the classic modern philosophies are attempts to try to understand how from a situation of lawlessness, the grip of law and the authority of law could be understood to have some sort of psychological reality. So Westerns actually sort of reenact a founding myth, the founding of society yeah. itself.
And a related myth, and this character is very well played, particularly by Wayne in mm-hmm. the John Ford films, yeah. is the old gunfighter, the old gunslinger, who's really been outdated.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's come to terms sort of with time having passed him by.
Yeah, and then it's very often the case that the civilized order, this is particularly true of one of the greatest Westerns about this, Shane, the George Stevens movie mm-hmm. with Alan Ladd, that even though the civilized order has been instituted, it's not stable enough. It's still relatively fragile, and so they need, at some point or another, an extra legal force to enforce the authority of the law. And that sort of renders problematic the nature of the law itself if it has to depend on
that
extra legal force.
That happens more than once. It happens in Shane. It happens in The Shootist.
Yeah, that's one of John Wayne's last films, and a very good one, too. Yeah,
and a few others.
Thing. Yeah, yeah.
There's one in which Gregory Peck was a retired...
The Gunfighter.
Gunfighter.
Gunfighter. That's a Henry King movie.
He's called back into action.
Yeah, The Gunfighter. Exactly. Yeah. Called back into action again. Yeah, and they're always being sought by the young. They want to quit. They want actually not to be an extra legal force anymore. They're tired of it. They actually want the domestic virtues of domestic bourgeois society,
but
they're not allowed to.
Is the last of those, at least the last of those, done well and with true compelling artistry, that Clint Eastwood film?
Unforgiven.
Unforgiven.
Exactly right. The only person who's going to exact justice for what was done to those women is somebody outside the law, and he's the only one who can do it. Very reluctant, doesn't want to do it. That's a very familiar theme in Westerns, but he does it. That's also a kind of mythic situation because he won't really engage in action until his friend is killed.
Yeah.
It's like an Achilles Patroclus thing from ancient Greek epic stories, that it's not until he feels the pull of the personal that he's able to actually act in the name of justice.
The reference back to the Iliad.
Yeah.
If you take all these major themes in, say, American film noir, or more particularly for what we're discussing tonight, in American Westerns, are they all somehow anticipated or modeled on yet earlier narrative?
It's part of what I argue, that these genre films, everything from romantic comedies that evoke Shakespeare and the late romantic comedies of Shakespeare, to film noir, which are very much about the Greek conception of fate, to Westerns, which are about founding myths in the same way, that these are archetypal patterns of narration that have a particular purchase in American society. And when the studio system was in its heyday, there was enough money around for there to be an enormous amount of experimentation in invoking these classic patterns of narration and characterization. And Westerns are a paradigmatic example of how mythic narration still grips the imagination of the people who watch them.
Well, in 10 minutes, you've laid the basis for our further discussion. We are tonight going to be doing sort of a seminar around some scenes. All we have is the audio, of course, this being radio.
Yeah.
But you might, as we set them, briefly describe the visual aspects
sure.
as well.
Sure.
And we'll listen to those scenes and we'll analyze further and sort of do a textual elaboration of the theme
That'd be great.
Already
sure.
laid down in the first phase of our conversation. So with that, we pause briefly for a round of commercials, and then we return to Robert Pippin. And the first film we'll go to directly with a few scenes from it is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight is Robert B. Pippin. That's spelled P-I-P-P-I-N. And we're drawing from his book, published, I guess, about a year and a half ago, and just now reissued in paperback. By Yale University Press.
That's right.
Titled Hollywood Westerns and American Myth. And the further subtitle, as I change to my reading glasses, The Importance of Howard Hawks and John Ford for Political Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's keep that in mind. Let's go directly to a film by John Ford.
Mm-hmm.
The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah.
Frame it generally. Most of our listeners half of our listeners probably have seen it, half haven't.
Well, they may have heard the song, the Gene Pitney song, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. That became a big hit. But this was 1962. This was, for many people who are fans of Ford, his last great work of genius. He made a lot of other movies, but this was the sort of culmination of his career in another way. And the scene we're going to listen to concerns one of the many ways in which political unity in a community of people who don't know each other as members of the same kin or family as possible. And that's by a kind of myth about the origin, an explicit myth. And in this case, the myth is a lie. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is a reference to Jimmy Stewart's supposedly heroic act in ridding the town of the scourge of extra-legal violence by a character named Liberty Valance, played in a great turn by Lee Marvin.
Yep.
And we learn in the course of the movie, before we see, this is the very end of the movie, in the course of the scene, that he didn't really shoot Liberty Valance, that what was necessary...
He would have been shot down by Liberty Valance.
He would have been killed easily. He couldn't really handle a gun. He had a very old weapon, and Liberty Valance was the hottest gun in the West.
But his competitor for the hand of the heroine, the lovely woman
Vera
in
Miles,
the film,
Hallie.
Is none other than John Wayne.
John Wayne.
And secretly, John Wayne is standing up there, and he shoots Liberty Valance.
In a dishonorable way. He shoots him from an ambush in the dark without a fair fight, violating every code of the Old West. But he does it because he knows Hallie wants it, and that it's the only way that the Rance Stoddard character, Jimmy Stewart, will accept the fact that Liberty Valance is dead. So after we see a scene in which the truth is told to him, he doesn't tell anybody else the truth, and he lives out the rest of his life on the basis of the lie, which is a kind of big metaphorical issue in the movie, whether the political community he's founded is actually based on a lie, a fabrication, or not. And after he tells the story to a newspaper man whom he hopes will tell the truth about the story, finally, we hear this scene.
Wonderful. Here it is.
Well, you know the rest of it. I went to Washington. We won statehood. I became the first governor.
3 terms as governor, 2 terms in the Senate, ambassador to the court of St. James, back again to the Senate, and a man who, with a snap of his fingers, could be the next vice president of the United States.
You're not going to use the story, Mr. Scott?
No, sir. This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
He's right, Rance.
Wonderful scene. And, of course, that's the great surprise of the film. That's the key to the film.
Yeah.
But now going back to your subtitle about political philosophy, what does this tell us about the way in which polities emerge, mature, and are held together?
Well, in this case, it raises a very serious question. I mean, we tend to think as philosophers that the real question about the fundamental issue of politics is the concentration of the power to use coercive violence in the hands of some people who purport to act in the name of all.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, for political philosophy, the question is, on what argument, on what basis of what appeal to reason is that claim justified? But we sort of see in this movie that people need to believe something about their political unity that goes beyond what the ordinary citizen can actually reproduce as an argument for the legitimacy of power. And in this case, it's an idealizing myth that a founder has rid the town of a scourge of violence, and the community has been founded by this great act of courage. And it's the mythic story itself that actually contributes to the acceptance of this concentration of power in the hands of the police, essentially. But what we see in the movie is that the entire basis on which the mythic enthusiasm for the polity is generated and sustained is a lie. And this scene is very controversial because most people accept it as Wayne's own view that it's necessary for the polis, for the political community, to have a kind of founding myth, whether it's true or not. But the great irony of the movie, of course, is that the movie has just shown us, everybody who watched the movie, that what is appealed to as the founding myth is, in fact, false, is a lie. So the criticism of Ford as a conservative who wants to justify the use of propaganda for the sake of the integrity of the political unit is undermined by the fact that the movie itself shows us exactly what is true and what is not true.
It's interesting you mention his interest in using propaganda for the sake of the social whole. That's just what he did during the war, isn't it?
He did. He was a very patriotic filmmaker during the war and made a lot of films. And, I mean, who could deny that in war, especially, given the pressures and tensions that war creates on the home front, you need a kind of, what I call in the book, political psychology. You need a kind of attention to the emotional life of the citizens.
But he made those films not in Hollywood. He made them for the U.S. government.
Exactly. Yeah.
They were war reportage.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Although he did make films like Sands of Iwo Jima, and he made war films that were quite patriotic films.
Yeah. Well, they were documentary during the war.
Well, so he also made fiction films that were celebratory of the American victory in World War II, as did many, many other people. Anthony Mann.
It's a wonderful career. When I am asked who's your favorite director, I routinely answer John Ford.
Yeah, well, when they asked Orson Welles who's your favorite, who are your 3 favorite directors, he said John Ford, and John Ford.
But I love him not solely for the Westerns, but for some of the other great films. The Informer is one of the most perfect films I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
The one with the merchant seaman, what is it called now? I'm blocking on it.
Yeah,
but it's from the Glencairn plays of Eugene O'Neill.
Yeah.
You, woven together into one film. And then
The Quiet Man, you mean?
Yeah, no, The Quiet Man is something else. And then the great one set in Wales.
The Quiet Man's in Ireland. I don't know.
The Quiet Man is in Ireland, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
How Green Was My Valley
How
is
Green
the one
was
in
my
Wales,
valley, yeah.
But be that as it may, he had a tremendously long career also in terms of productivity.
He did, yeah. Yeah, somebody told me once, there's a philosopher in Oregon who's Robert Ryan's son.
Oh, yes?
And he grew up in Hollywood with these two people, especially Robert Ryan was very close to both of them. And he said that John Wayne was the nicest man, his father said, John Wayne was the nicest man he ever met, but the stupidest, unfortunately. And that John Ford was the most intelligent man he ever met and the meanest.
Yeah,
John Ford was a mean man, a very, very bitter and difficult man to get along with.
One knows that in his private life he had for a while a close relationship with Katharine Hepburn before she got involved
with Spencer Tracy. Yeah, right. Yeah,
and any man whom Katharine Hepburn found worthy,
yeah, exactly,
couldn't have been all bad.
Couldn't have been all bad, exactly.
But let's do another quick scene from Liberty Balance. We have a second one.
Yeah,
and this is aboard a railroad. This is, I guess, aboard a train.
This
or
is the last scene in the movie.
The very last scene in the movie. And he's talking with the conductor, I think.
Yeah.
Boots are here. I guess my heart is here. Yes, let's come back. Look at it. It was once a wilderness. Now it's a garden. Aren't you proud?
Allie, who put the cactus roses on Tom's coffin?
I did.
I got a brand new spittoon for you, cuspidor, Allie. And Luke the engineer's got a full head of steam in this old tar bucket. We're going to make 25 miles an hour bust a boiler trying. And... we wired ahead to Junction City. They're going to hold the express for you. Rance, in 2 days and two nights, you're going to be right back in Washington.
Oh, thank you, Jason. Thank you, and I'm going to write a letter to the officials of this railroad and thank them for their kindness and for going to all this trouble.
You think nothing of it. Nothing's too good for the man who shot Liberty Valance.
How many organizing central figures in the histories of various societies have arisen by virtue of their having been the dragon slayer, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a very familiar mythic scene. Although in this one, again, we get a different kind of inflection on it being merely mythic.
Yeah.
Because there's a connection here between the fact that Hallie was once beloved of Tom Donovan, the hero, John Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a scene I think this is deliberate by John Ford, who of course knew Irish literature very well. It's kind of evocative of the short story The Dead, where a man finds out that his wife has loved another man her whole life at her funeral.
And that's the James Joyce story.
Exactly. And in this scene, she talks about the achievement of civilized life in this town and says, aren't you proud? And all he's concerned with is why she put a cactus rose on the coffin of her now dead once lover. And I think he begins to suspect that not only is the kind of civilizational project that he's given his life to built on a falsehood, but that his marriage is built on a falsehood, that she not only loved Tom Donovan once, she may still love him. And you can't see it on radio, obviously, but after the man says nothing is too good for the man who shot Liberty Valance, it's kind of a bitter irony that your whole life has been built on something that's not true, which sort of suggests that maybe the civilizational achievement is built on something that is very fragile and can easily be dissolved by the truth. But that is, his marriage is a kind of figure for the same problem, that she all of her life actually preferred the man she left for him.
This is possibly irresponsible thought, but I'm just free associating. This is a time in which the dictatorial heads of various states are being pulled down. Mm-hmm. And the sustaining myth which kept, say, a Mubarak in position for so long, or Assad, who inherited his father's charisma, supposedly. Those sustaining myths keep them going for quite a while, and people yield to them, maybe partly out of compulsion rather than out of deep sincerity, but all the same, they accept it until something goes wrong, really wrong, and indeed you get a kind of a fire spreading across the Middle East, in this case, across the Mediterranean, literal, as one after another falls. It's as if the myth can be very easily punctured once there's a model for going against the tyrant, or once somehow the tyrant shows his weakness and shows his cowardice.
Yeah, a lot of these Westerns deal with different ways in which the stability of political unity can be undermined. I mean, in this one, the town seems to be mostly based on this sustaining myth about the original heroism of the founding. But in Red River, for example, it's the charisma of John Wayne, the charismatic leader alone. And in The Searchers, it's kinship. It's actually race, or a kind of bond that is natural or pre-civilizational. So Westerns actually explore a number of different dimensions in which political unity...
And in every one of these films, the real hero is John Wayne.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have to examine why, what there was about him that made him just right for those roles.
Interesting question.
We will... And what the persona was that he carries across those three films, and probably many of the others as well, the Wayne character as such.
Right.
We'll get into all of that as we continue right now to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
It's an illustrated discussion tonight, a discussion of the Western for what it tells us about, I suppose the myths by which we lived as the country expanded and went west. There is a whole great tradition, indeed it premiered at on our campus, not because the man was from the University of Chicago, he was from Wisconsin, but he appeared at the great Columbian Exposition, which was on the Midway and elsewhere. I have in mind the historian who gave us the frontier hypothesis. Frederick Jackson Turner.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you're dealing with a variant of the frontier hypothesis, aren't you?
Yeah, especially in the film we're talking about next, Red River, which is a film very much in the shadow of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, Westerns are often about foundings. And many Westerns are actually shadowed by the fact that the American founding failed. It resulted in a fratricidal, bloody Civil War from which you could argue quite plausibly the nation has yet to recover. And Red River is very much infused with this problem of secession, mutiny. The film is about a mutiny, both John Wayne's mutiny at the beginning when he leaves the wagon train they think he promised to stay in, and then later when the men revolt against him.
And though Freudianism, which once attracted lots of people who did critical writing, whether about literature or about movies or about whatever, though Freudianism has rather faded, in fact, we have in this film the pure Oedipal theme, haven't we?
Yeah, we have a young man played by Montgomery Clift, who is the adopted son, a foundling, another great mythic scene, a man whose parents have been killed, who's adopted by John Wayne. Matter of fact, I mean, the Freudian theme is so explicit it's almost embarrassing. After the Indian attack, they're left with John Wayne having a bull but no cow, and Montgomery Clift, the young boy, having a cow but no bull. And so the two of them have to form this kind of quasi-erotic bond in order to propagate and to have a herd to establish a new beginning in the West across the Red River. And it's only after the Civil War has sort of broken the bonds of the politic in the United States that they come back together and try to reestablish yet again a new venture, this time a great cattle drive to Missouri so that they can actually sell their cattle. And it's on the cattle drive again that the political unity of the group again breaks down. It's unstable.
And it's the revolt of the prince against the king.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the scene we're going to see.
And at issue, of course, as well, is the loyalty and the stolid presence of a beautiful woman.
Yeah. I mean,
played by a very beautiful woman, Joanne Drew.
Joanne Drew, in the latter part of the movie. That's actually a part of the movie that isn't as successful as the rest of it.
Oh, really?
Because you had to have a female lead, so about two-thirds of the way through the movie, they had to stumble across a wagon train that has a whole bunch of women in it. And there's a sort of hastily put-together scene in which the woman ends up being kind of the agent of reconciliation between the two of them at the end. But before that happens, the drive is under a lot of pressure, and they're losing men, and there's a stampede, and things are falling apart. The pressure is becoming enormous. And a group of men try to leave. And John Wayne sends one of his henchmen out to get the people back. And then he's planning to hang them, which is a grotesque kind of insistence on himself being like a legal authority, the law.
And his stepson, Montgomery Clift, mm-hmm. says, no, you won't.
No, you won't. Yeah.
And that's the beginning of the direct confrontation between father and stepson.
That's right.
And here is that scene.
The whole wide state. I shouldn't have run away. I should have stayed and put a bullet in you. I signed the pledge, sure, but you ain't the man I signed it with.
You finished?
Yeah. Now you can get your Bible and read over us after you shoot us.
I'm gonna hang you.
No. No, you're not.
What?
You're not going to hang them.
Who'll stop me?
I will.
Gun. Somebody give me.
I'll kill him. Let me go.
He was going to kill me.
He was going to give me a chance.
Yeah.
Turn him loose. Jerry, give me that gun. Here's what you've been crying for. All right, use it. Go on. You got what you wanted. What are you waiting for? If you don't want to live, all you have to do is. Lucky man, dealer. So close it came. Matt Wiggett and as crazy as he is. Keep it. You want to finish the drive?
Where are we going?
Abilene.
Who's heading it?
I am.
What about Dunson?
He stays here. We're taking the herd.
That's good enough for me.
I'm with you, Matt.
I'll go along.
I'll stay along. That's all right.
Ruth, how about you?
You was wrong, Mr. Dunson. I've been with you a lot of years. And up till now, right or wrong, all is done like you said. Got to be kind of a habit with me, I guess, because that's why I'm staying with you.
Go on with him.
Thanks. Thanks for making it easy on me.
All right, Matt, I'll be coming with you.
Throw him on the trail. Start driving. Buster, you wait here till I get back.
If you come looking for me, Mr. Dunson, I'll be in Abilene.
There was steady old Walter Brennan.
Indeed, Groot, that was the character who said, I've been with you a lot of years. Yeah, yeah. The reference to Abilene is that in this sort of more complicated society that is being built in the near West, in West Texas, the men have heard that there's a new route to Missouri, that they can go. They don't have to go to Missouri. There's a new route to the train station where they can sell their cattle in Abilene. But it's testimony. It's not fact.
Uh-huh.
And so the basis of civil society, very often business deals, for example, require a certain level of trust, a certain level of civil comity among participants in the civil society. And Dunson is old school. If he hasn't seen it, he doesn't believe that there can be this level of trust in a complicated society. So the people who are revolting against him are angry that he won't believe the testimony that they've heard, that there is a new route to sell the cattle. And that's why the mutiny, apart from the brutality of wanting to hang these men, they're frustrated that he won't, in fact, accept the fact that you sometimes have to rely on the testimony of others to get the business done.
A sidebar of no relevance, but do you remember the song of some 20 or 30 years ago, Abilene, Abilene, mm-hmm. prettiest town I've ever seen?
Mm-hmm.
Women there don't treat you mean in Abilene. Wonderful tune.
Yeah.
The man who wrote it, I heard him interviewed once, said when he wrote it, he wasn't sure He didn't know there were two Abilenes. He wasn't sure whether it was Abilene, Texas, or Abilene,
Kansas.
Kansas, that he's writing about.
Yeah.
But this is Abilene, Texas.
This is Abilene, Kansas. They're actually going to take a different route to a new rail station where they have 9,000 head of cattle.
Oh, they're going to Abilene, Kansas.
Yeah, they have 9,000 head of cattle, and they can't sell them. So they're trying to go to Missouri. But they hear there's a route that'll cut 1,000 miles off their trail. But they only hear it. They hear it from other number of sources. But as I say, it's a kind of figure for the fact that the more complicated world they live in doesn't have a place for men like Dunson, who's a kind of independent czar or tyrant.
The princeling challenges the king. Sometimes that's happened in real life, and the king kills the prince. Sometimes the prince, thinking of models and thinking of archetypes, the story of David and...
You mean Saul? Saul. You mean Saul?
Saul and who revolts against the father in the Old Testament?
Yeah, that's David and Saul.
David and Saul.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Very famous scene in the cave.
And that's the prototype of
many of
this sort of thing.
Or Cain revolting against God or something.
But
like that.
What happens in the rest of the film?
Yeah, well,
we have to explain that to some of the people who've not seen
it. For the next scene. Yeah, so they mutiny and they take over the herd.
Yeah,
and
they're off to Abilene.
Yeah. And, I mean, that one line that you heard in the scene, sure, I signed the pledge, but you ain't the man I signed it with, is a very resonant claim in American history because it's the claim of the Confederacy, which, as I say, shadows the movie. The Confederate argument was, yes, we agreed to be in the Union, but the Union we agreed to be with had slavery written into the Constitution. You ain't the Union we signed with. It's the same sort of thing with Dunson insisting they can't leave. He's saying they can't leave no matter that the conditions have changed. It's much more brutal than they thought when they were signing up. Well, they do go to Abilene. They do sell the cattle. They make a huge profit. But at the end of the movie, there's a very, very dramatic scene where John Wayne, who's rounded up a band of brigands, is coming to exact his vengeance on the Montgomery Clift.
And he's going
to
kill Montgomery Clift.
He's going to kill him. He's going to beat him to death. Yeah. They're going to have a fight to the death. And this is what we expect, in a way, from the mythic framework, that there will be... And usually it's the son who kills the father or the stepson or the prince who kills the king. But in this scene, they have a fight. And as we were saying in the break, the credibility of the fight is really amazingly staged because, you know, John Wayne is 6'3", 6'4", you know, 220, 230. And Montgomery Clift, very tiny man and somewhat feminine. But the fight is very credible. And they begin to fight, and they clearly are not going to kill each other. But at some point, the woman, Joanne Drew, as you mentioned before, intervenes. And that is the basis of the scene we're going to see, where she really says, this fight is a shadow fight. This war between an old charismatic view of political authority and a new fraternal, more egalitarian view. Actually, what she says is, it's not a real battle. You're both trying to get the cattle to business.
Yeah.
To a place where you can do business with them. And so there's actually kind of a very subtle undermining.
She's saying you're not fooling anybody.
Yeah, yeah. And there's not really a fight here. Yeah. This is not really a transition to a more just fraternal order. This is just a better way of getting the cattle to market. It's a very interesting claim she makes that really, in reality...
But it's also yielding by the tough and somewhat uncontainable charismatic presence, capable of aggression and meanness and murder, if necessary.
Right.
He is tamed and is yielding to the law-oriented son.
Except, you know, it's really one form of authority versus another.
All right.
He's just outdated. And what Montgomery Clift has done is sort of co-opted everyone into agreement, although he's still the leader. And what we see in the last scene is an incorporation of his mark in the brand of the ranch, which is a very kind of feudal, old, pre-world notion of authority.
Here's where that is said.
When are you going to stop telling people what to do?
Right now. At least as soon as...
When?
As soon as I tell you one thing more.
What?
When we get back to the ranch, I want you to change the brand. It'll be like this. Red River D. We'll add an M to it. You don't mind that, do you?
No.
That's some distance from the original myth as set down in the Iliad, set down in lots of things from classical antiquity, as set down in Freudian interpretation of how religion began in Totem and Taboo,
that's
where
right,
the princelings
yeah.
literally kill their father
yeah.
and actually devour him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This ending was criticized a lot because given the sort of emotional power of the whole movie, it seems a little hokey. And Hawks was criticized for ending the movie on this kind of sentimental note. But I think most people who criticize him for that don't get the irony of the fact that actually Matt has taken over the role of Dunson. He hasn't really transformed
yeah.
the nature of authority. He's just made it more successfully modern.
You told me a wonderful story about Hawks and John Ford and what they had to say to each other about John Wayne.
Yeah.
You told me that while we were off the air, and I want you to retell that story when we return right
sure.
after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are back. We've been struggling to get some of our Old Testament references
right.
right. But let's come back to the what John Ford learned from seeing this film that we've just been listening to, namely Red River.
Well, Red River is 1948, and John Ford had been using Wayne as an actor from well into the early 30s in bit parts and then secondary roles and then finally in a starring role
in Stagecoach,
which
was a superb and beautiful film.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful film at Stagecoach. But he still, you know, didn't give Wayne a whole lot to do. Wayne's very young in the movie there. He's still in his mid-30s or so. And it wasn't until he saw this movie in 1948, I don't know if you could say this on the radio, but he finally said to Hawks, I didn't know the son of a bitch could act.
Uh-huh.
And after seeing this movie, from that moment on in the Cavalry trilogy and in The Searchers and in Liberty Valance, he began to give Wayne much more challenging
And the one in which
roles.
He plays Rooster?
Well, that's much later. It's not a Ford film.
That's not a Ford film either.
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But the problem that Hawks created, that both Hawks and Ford agreed, was once they sort of unleashed Wayne as an actor, who's mm-hmm. still to this day, I think because of his political activity in the 60s and so forth, Wayne is kind of denigrated as a cartoonish sort of character. But he's a very great screen actor. I don't think he'd be a great stage actor. But he has a kind of mysterious presence on camera that some people have and some people don't. But Hawks and Ford used to complain that if they didn't balance the characters right, Wayne would just blow people off the screen. Nobody would find anybody else credible.
Is it the case with him, as it is often argued with great film stars of the classic variety, that they are actors, they can play many roles, but essentially there's a kind of a continuity across all roles. The persona that
yeah.
comes from inside the person somehow shapes and fills the role as assigned.
Yeah, exactly. But in Red River, you saw for the first time, Wayne, first of all, played a character much older than himself.
Uh-huh.
So Dunson in Red River is maybe 15 years older than Wayne was at the time. Gray hair, makeup, and everything else, and other makeup to make him look aged. And he actually goes crazy in the movie. On the road, he's injured. He has a lot of chronic pain. He's drinking heavily. And he really does a very good job of playing a man completely like Captain Queeg sort of thing in Mutiny on the Bounty. He loses control completely. And that was the first time you could see that Wayne didn't have to play just the silent, strong gunfighter. Or yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, ride the mm-hmm. horse off into the sunset, that he had a much bigger range. And so Ford was encouraged to give him a much more complicated role in The Searchers, where he plays the darkest character he's ever played.
Now, how does all of this relate to American myth work, to our founding myths and the transmutations that we worked upon them as we grow as a nation?
Well, I think one of the Westerns are often criticized for being nothing but kind of jingoistic, patriotic celebrations mm-hmm. of the conquest of the West. But that's true of, you know, say 90% of the B-Westerns that were the second feature on double bills when the movie studios controlled all the theater houses and they could make everybody take two movies, and hundreds of Westerns were produced almost every year. But it's not true of the great Westerns, the Westerns of Hawks and Ford and Anthony Mann and Bud Bedecker and Sam Fuller and the really great directors of Westerns, the very, very high-quality Westerns, all have a very unsettling kind of dark side in which the possibility of a kind of experiment like the United States, not a nation built on a commonly occupied territory for centuries, but an allegiance formed from people who are essentially ethnic strangers to each other, whose only form of political union is allegiance to common principles. The Westerns both kind of celebrate the aspiration, like Stagecoach is a very good film that celebrates the aspiration for a society built on the equal moral worth of every individual without a common ethnic or national background or heritage. But most of these Westerns are also not necessarily pessimistic, but also speculative about whether or not this is going to succeed.
One way to measure the quality of a Western, I think, one additional way, is what they do with and about Indians.
Yeah. And most of the Westerns I'm talking about in this book, except for the last one, which is very much focused on the issue of racial hatred in the settling of the West. That's not so much a feature of Liberty Valance, and it's not so much a feature of Red River, although there is a clear conquest of the lands the Indians occupied by John Wayne when he settles the land. Although, and there's also a kind of murderous rivalry with the Mexicans who are near the Texas border in Red River. But I think the greatest film about the fact that the settlement of the West was actually the near genocide of the Aboriginal peoples is The Searchers.
Yes, and we're coming to that after we pause for a round of news and commercials, which is coming in just about a minute and a half. But you mentioned various directors. One other one that comes to mind, and I dislike him, I actively dislike him, though I know he's considered of some eminence and to have had his own particular stamp, is Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, well, Peckinpah made a lot of bad films, but he made two that in the Western canon I think really do deserve attention. So I agree with you, he's a very uneven director. But this Western, Ride the High Country, you know, Westerns have a cycle. In other words, they became popular at a time, and then their credibility began to fail. And Ride the High Country is one of the best Westerns about the declining credibility of this mythic repetition of this narrative pattern. These are two older men who no longer have a role in society. They're carnival, cartoon-like characters. Mm-hmm. They're featured. There are a lot of Westerns like this about Wild West shows, rodeo movies are very much about the death of the credibility of the Western myth. And Peckinpah did a very good scent movie about the declining self-image of America when the frontier was finally closed down. And there
but most no of his films are very brutalized.
Yeah, and The Wild Bunch is also a movie about the the end of the Western, and was very notorious for its graphic use of violence and so forth. But underlying it, it's a very elegiac film about the end of the West and the impossibility of the sustaining of this notion of a new founding. New founding is over with.
Almost thou just persuade me. I have to take Peckinpah more seriously, I guess. And I'll probably dig out one of his films and re-examine my attitude towards him. Right now, my attitude clearly is one of obeisance to the rules of radio as we go to the WGN newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We will undoubtedly be talking about yet other great Western films once our callers come in, because we will be interested in whatever suggestions you've got about other films worthy of appreciation and, for that matter, of some analysis. And we're going to get to the calls probably in about 15 minutes, though we are opening the phone lines at this instant. The number, as ever, is 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. And for those on the Pacific Rim who are great enthusiasts for American Westerns, you can reach us, of course, if you're listening to us over the Internet. You can reach us via email, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 is one word, at WGNradio.com. Or, again, for phones, 312-591-7200. If you don't mind waiting a bit, get in there and get in line. We look forward to talking with you in a while. But we come now to something that you have designated. You did this again while we were off air. Dare I repeat it? You said the single greatest film ever made is?
The Searchers.
The Searchers.
Yep.
It's a strong assertion, man.
1956, yeah. I found it absolutely hypnotic and engrossing film in every possible way. See something new in it every time I see it. Mm-hmm. One of the most carefully made films ever made. And for me, just even slightly better than, Citizen Kane.
Right. So let us come to it. And there's John Wayne right in the middle of it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And his best performance by far.
Mm-hmm.
Although, screen actors, they're subject to really great direction in a way that there's plenty of evidence that Wayne never really understood the character that he played. In interviews after the film, if he had known he was playing such a disagreeable character, he wouldn't have done it. He was very protective of the kind of type he thought he ought to represent in movies. But the fact that he plays a racist who is bent on killing an 11-year-old girl because she's been taken by the Indians never really sort of seemed to hit home.
She's no longer 11. She's now 17 or 18.
Well, at the end of the, after the five-year search. But when she's first taken, he goes after her to kill her because he thinks she's been ruined by being – he's such a racist. He thinks she's been ruined by being with the Indians. So there's plenty of evidence that in terms of his internal motivation, Wayne didn't really understand the character. But he was such an intuitively good screen actor that he conveys the kind of darkness of the Ethan Edwards character with amazing force and vivacity.
Set it a little bit more. There's the family back there in Monument Valley where –
It's actually a ridiculous scene. They have a cattle ranch but in what looks like a desert. There's no water. There's no grass. There's no possible way they could make a living in this pathetic outpost.
But Ford had become very enamored of Monument Valley.
But
as
the
place
scenery was
photos.
So spectacular that Ford was willing to risk a little realism in order to photograph it. So Ethan Edwards is returning home. Again, another movie, another Western in the shadow of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. He was a Confederate in the Civil War. And after the South lost, he, like many Southern soldiers who didn't join the Union Army, which was an offer that they made, moved to Mexico to fight as a mercenary for Maximilian when the French were occupying Mexico and defending themselves against the revolution that Maximilian and John Wayne's people eventually lost. And he comes home after being in a kind of placeless way. He has no place. The South is lost. The mercenary job is over. And he comes home to his brother's cattle ranch, where it's quite clear that he had prior to the war, a romantic relationship with his brother's wife, which greatly complicates everything that happens in the movie. It would take a long time to really explain, but the ranch is rustled and the cattle are stolen. They go off looking for them, and it's a feint. The Indians come and destroy the house, kill and rape the brother's wife, and take the two daughters. And Wayne and his party set off after them to try to find them. And they search for them for 5 years. Some people, it's unclear, some people think it's even like 7 years that they search for them. But Wayne, after about 20, 30 minutes into the search, we realize, as does Jeffrey Hunter, who plays Martin Pauley, the young man who searches with him, he's the other searcher, we realize that his purpose is not to rescue her, but to kill her.
Why?
Well, as I said before, you know, Wayne has this kind of vitriolic hatred of Indians. And it's probably quite accurate to characterize that as racism, but it's also not just like a biological racism as a belief system. It's the product of war. And one of the sort of interesting undercurrents of the movie is the way in which, especially in the United States, the experience of war creates a kind of fratricidal hatred that's very hard to overcome. The hatred between the North and the South, for example, but also the hatred that was engendered during the Indian Wars in the West. And Wayne's racism, which is virulent and uncompromising, is also the product of a number of his own people having been murdered or killed or captured by the Indians. And we see in his counterpart in the Indians, a chief named Scar, that that's also true of him. That his hatred of whites, or rather racist hatred of whites, his absolute blanket hatred of all whites, is quite clearly understandable in the light of what's happened to him. So the film sets us on this journey in order to see whether Martin can stop him. Martin now continues on the search because he wants to stop him from killing Debbie. The only one of the young girls is left. The other one was killed on the way. We want to see whether John Wayne will actually shoot an unarmed, innocent girl.
The parallel between that and Red River, of course, is perfectly clear. In Red River, he's going to kill his son, his stepson.
Yeah.
And this one, he's going to kill his niece.
He's going to kill his niece,
In both cases, he relents, and the wild man is tamed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he's tamed or not, but there is a moment at which...
He's profoundly altered. He's civilized.
I wouldn't go that far, you know. When there's a famous scene at the very end of the movie, really has to be seen visually to be appreciated.
Yeah.
When
the one framed in the doorway.
He brings her back, but he can't enter the house.
Yeah.
There are four crucial scenes in the movie where you look from inside a dark house outside. So the boundary between the civilized world inside the house and the lawless world outside is very clear in imagistic terms. And Wayne, at the end of the movie, is outside and wanders off alone. And the Sons of the Pioneers sing a song throughout the movie. what makes a man to wander, which is, plays a crucial role in one of the scenes we're going to listen to.
Let's take the first of them, a very brief scene in which Jeffrey Hunter and Vera Miles are having an argument about Hunter.
They're home briefly, and they've interrupted a marriage that she was going to be in with somebody else because she's really supposed to be with him by movie logic. We all understand that. But after they've been home for a while and the marriage is interrupted, they're going to leave again. And then we discover that what we've now come to accept as an explanation for what's happening, that Wayne is a kind of rogue racist who doesn't represent the community, is false.
Mm-hmm.
That to our even greater horror, the attitude he has towards what he's doing is actually shared by what we have thus far come to understand as the most innocent and admirable character in the movie.
Here's a brief excerpt from that scene.
You're not going, not this time.
Crazy?
It's too late. She's a woman grown now.
I gotta go, Laurie. I gotta fetch her home.
Fetch what home? The leavings of Comanche Bucks sold time and again to the highest bidder with savage brats of her own.
Laurie, shut your mouth.
Do you know what Ethan will do if he has a chance? He'll put a bullet in her brain. I tell you, Martha would want him to.
Only if I'm dead.
How do I say at this moment that we've got to stop for some commercials?
That's a
but we do have
scene,
to stop for some commercials, and then we'll get to one of the major payoff scenes.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I am very eager for us to hear this scene and to get to the phones rather soon. We got lots of people waiting who would like to get in on this conversation. But set this up. We're not playing the full scene, but it's the one that's headed, the searchers finish the job.
Yeah, as they first start searching, this is when they're still searching for the cattle, they come across an Indian who's been killed and buried by their Indian comrades, and they can take a rock off the top of the grave and a bandana off, and they see the Indian's face. And again, this is our first indication that John Wayne is not a normal character in a normal Western, because he pulls out his pistol and shoots the eyes out of the Indian. He desecrates a dead body. This is before we learn he's going to kill an innocent girl. And the reason he gives is what's so interesting in the scene, because we begin to suspect that his hatred of Indians is a kind of self-hatred, that he's actually afraid that his own lack of a place in the civilized world, which he thinks he's excluded from by virtue of this illicit love with his brother's wife, makes him no fit member of this world either. And the tension in his voice as he makes clear he believes in the Indian religion and is actually willing to act on it.
I hope we heard that, because we're going into about the middle of the scene. It's a long scene, and I'm not sure whether we've already
emphasized
that.
Yeah.
But if not, we have that as background. Anyway, here it is.
A camp of the river about 20 miles from here. We'll wait till dark and then circle out so we can jump before daylight.
You right sure you want to jump them, Ethan?
That's what we came for, ain't it?
I thought we were trying to get them girls out. Alive. You jump them, Comanche. They'll kill them, you know that.
Well, what are we doing then, Reverend? What are we supposed to do, Ethan?
Well, what I had in mind was maybe running off their pony herd. A Comanche on foot's more apt to be willing to listen.
Yeah, I think the Reverend's right, don't you?
You think the Reverend's... What does a quarter-breed Cherokee know about the old Comanche trick of sleeping with his best pony tied right by his side? You got about as much chance of stampeding that herd as...
You have of finding them girls alive by raiding into them. I say we do it my way, Ethan, and that's an order.
Yes, sir. But if you're wrong, don't ever give me another...
Yeah, this is
we fade on that as they're What water are they crossing there?
They're trying to sneak up and run the ponies off so they can attack the Indians when they're weak and maybe get the jump on them and get the girls back. But you see in the beginning part of the scene, that's not what Wayne wants. They start to realize, to their horror, that the plan he has for attacking is not only indifferent to getting the girls killed, that's actually its purpose, that he wants to attack them in full force so they'll kill the hostages and run off and he won't have to kill the girls. So that's, you know, as you're viewing the movie for the first time, you can't really believe that. You think you must have misunderstood something, that they don't get Wayne right, that he must have some other plan. So the movie sort of leads you up to this almost unbearable, especially given the kind of character Wayne has been, this unbearable realization that he's not John Wayne in this movie. He's not out to rescue the girls, that his first purpose, and this is the scene in which they first suspect it. Now, what happens is they're completely unsuccessful, and the Indians stage an attack. They almost get wiped out, and this is when Wayne decides he's going to search alone. And the other members of the party realize they're not up to this task either, and that it's better for one man, or in this case two men, because Martin already suspects that his purposes are perhaps suspect. Martin joins him, and that's the beginning of the 5-year search for this obsessive, nearly insane search for the
How
girls.
Does it come? I'm trying to remember the film. I haven't seen it in many years. How does he come to the moment of transformation in which, rather than killing his niece, whom he's finally got in his hands,
it's just one of the greatest scenes in movie history. I mean, Godard says in his Histoire du Cinéma that it is the greatest scene
in movie history
because everything is set up. The day before, she had run from the camp to tell them to leave, that she doesn't want to leave the camp, that it's too dangerous, that they should just go. But when Wayne sees her, he pulls his pistol and aims at her. Jeffrey Hunter steps in front of them, and he fires. He's going to kill Jeffrey Hunter so that he can then kill her. But as he fires, an arrow hits his arm. The Indians have realized she's escaped, and he misses. He has this arrow wound in his arm, and they run off, and Debbie runs back to the camp. That's sort of the setup for the last scene we'll hear. But we're absolutely convinced that he's going to kill her because we saw him with the pistol aiming at her. But in the last scene, after they attack the Indians and Scar is killed, he is running after her on horseback, and she's riding. She's running on foot, and he corners her in an area, gets off the horse, and in the shooting script, a very maudlin scene occurs when Wayne is supposedly sighting down his rifle and says something like, "You look too much like Martha. Let's go home." Yeah. But in the scene Ford actually filmed, he dispenses with all of that. And as he moves toward her, you think he's going to kill her. And then in this unbelievable moment, he just picks her up in the same geometry as happened at the beginning of the movie when he picks her up and lifts her when she was a small child over her head. And then he cradles her in his arms and says, "Let's go home, Debbie."
Yeah. I'm afraid we're not going to hear that or any other scene because we're so late. And we have listeners to get to, and we have commercials to take care of. Let's take a call, if we can, one or two, before we pause for the newscast, and we'll go on with calls throughout the rest of the available time. So, 312-591-7200, and we go directly to Thad. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milt. I wanted to talk about a slightly later era in the Western and the influence of Akira Kurosawa on Westerns.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and do so.
Who basically invented the spaghetti Western. He made the Magnificent Seven. He made the Seven Samurai, which was directly copied into the Magnificent Seven. And then later, Sanjuro and Yojimbo, which created the character that later became made famous by Clint Eastwood in his Man with No Name trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a possible line of influence. I wonder whether you agree.
Yeah. Oh, there's a number of connections. I mean, who copies whom is sort of up for debate because Kurosawa is clearly influenced by Westerns as well. But what's interesting is that Kurosawa uses the historical period of the transition from the feudal period to the modern period, in which the samurai were no longer necessary, to stage the same kind of mythic, almost tragic conflict between the forces of order and authority in the feudal period, who no longer have a role or a function, but who kind of wander useless in the emerging post-feudal world of Japan. The spaghetti westerns are another kind of issue besides the Kurosawa similarity. The spaghetti westerns, at least the ones that have become most famous, the ones you mentioned, the Clint Eastwood westerns, have an unusual feature in being not located in a historical place and time. No one has names. Places don't have names. You're not even sure what country it's in. They have an even more abstract, mythic form, so that you're dealing with what are essentially primitive forces in collision rather than the specific location of the American Western, which is about the attempt to refound the nation after the Civil War.
A name that comes to me on the so-called spaghetti westerns is Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
Leone.
He's the most famous director of the spaghetti westerns. And as I say, what's so interesting about them is that they, in a way, denationalize and delocalize the Western so that they have nothing but a mythic force.
And they're almost silent. They have very little dialogue.
Extremely visually composed.
Our thanks to the caller. Let's quickly go to another. 312-591-7200. And Bob is next up. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Rosenberg. What a great show. I've been a John Wayne fan for approximately 50 years or more. I just love this show. I couldn't wait till you came on. Disagree ever so slightly, though, with you about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, one of my very favorite Westerns. I think in the movie, the character John Wayne played loved Vera Miles, Hallie, much more than she loved him. Mm. And I think he was just not able to become. He was a tough guy, and he just couldn't soften up to her enough. Whereas Jimmy Stewart did, and as a result, she fell in love with Jimmy Stewart. But she still had some feelings for John Wayne, you know, towards the end of the movie. Because you'll remember when John Wayne lost her by shooting Liberty Valance, he then tore down his honeymoon cabin and drank himself, into oblivion practically. Came back at the convention and told Jimmy Stewart to go in and give Hallie something to read about. So he loved her so much, you know, that he just couldn't let her go. One other point I wanted to make, too, is you talked about the directors, and one of them I think you forgot was John Sturges. Hmm. Because I think he produced one of the very best Westerns ever made, The Magnificent Seven, which is also one of my very favorites. It gave the big jump to four stars in that movie who weren't very popular at the time, but this gave them their boost to become great stars. Steve McQueen, Coburn, Robert Vaughn, and I forgot the fourth one. Charles Bronson. And it started them going. And this was a great movie with one of the great classic lines of all.
Now, that's
time.
Based on an earlier Kurosawa film made in Japan, isn't it?
Absolutely.
By the Ronin.
Right, the Seven Samurai. Samurai.
Yeah.
And one of the great classic lines in that movie was, if he is the best with a knife and a gun, with whom does he compete? And the answer was himself. Mm-hmm. What a great line. Another great line, and I'll let you go.
All right.
Another great line was Horace Buckles turning to James Coburn and saying, that was the greatest shot I've ever seen. And Coburn turns to him with a straight face and says, the worst. I was aiming for the horse.
That is good. Sir, thank you for the call.
Great show, though. I really enjoyed it.
I appreciate your appreciation. And we better pause right now and go to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
The fine book and a very fetching book, fetching you towards deeper thought about some of your favorite Western films. And a few others are mentioned in this book, apart from the three that we've focused on. The title of that book is Hollywood Westerns and American Myth. The author, Robert B. Pippin. A very moment out before we go directly back to the phones. How does a philosopher who's written about Nietzsche, who's done a good deal of work on Kant, who writes in German and in French, as well as in his native language, how does he come to doing what is really a film buff kind of book?
Yeah, well, that would probably be a long story, but the short version is just not only an appreciation of the greatness of these films, but a kind of frustration that the greatness is still not widely accepted, that it's actually considered sort of not just unusual, but kind of slumming for somebody who writes professionally in philosophy to work on what are considered mass consumer products churned out by studios for mass consumption. But the Hollywood system was a wonderful thing. With so much money and so many films being made, they could afford to give brilliant directors their head in making films that were commercially viable because, you know, 40 million people went to the movies every week. I mean, it was just very hard not to make money off movies at the time. So for a brief period from the late 30s to the early 50s, the Hollywood studio system made it possible to make works of such quality that they repay this kind of attention.
The Great Western is no longer an operative genre, is it?
No. There are occasionally, like we were talking about before, Unforgiven.
But that's 20 years ago already.
92 already, yeah. Yeah, and then they did a remake of 310 to Yuma a while back, the very fine Delmer Davies movie.
Oh, yeah.
With Glenn Ford. So you occasionally see the genre used or invoked, but often it's much more violent. There's mm-hmm. a good deal more emphasis on a kind of violent tension in the movie and not so much on these sort of mythic questions of yeah. how we narrate the nature of the country.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Lance is up. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, doctor. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Go ahead, please.
I remember back in the 60s, we were watching The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I think it was either Channel 5 or Channel 7, the 3 o'clock movie. And they cut the key scene out where it shows John Wayne shooting Lee Marvin. They cut it out, and we were watching, and we were like, what are you doing? Who's a knucklehead that cut that scene out?
Yeah.
And then right after the movie, the news came on, and their lead story was, please stop calling the TV station. We're going to show the scene during the newscast.
Yeah,
I'll never forget that.
That's great. All right, we thank you for that memory.
Okay, Doc.
And we'll go directly to another caller, 312-591-7200. And John is with us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I just wanted to bring up the performance of Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday in the most recent version of Tombstone. You know, I love movies and I love Westerns, and I just consider it one of the most underrated acting performances really in any genre. I don't remember if he was nominated for an Oscar or not as a supporting actor. I certainly believe he should have been. And if it's a movie that someone has not seen, perhaps they don't like the idea of more recent Westerns, I recommend it highly, specifically for his performance.
We agree, I think.
Okay.
But you know, that's a fortunate call because it reminds me yet of something else, with thanks to that caller. Another great John Ford film, you mentioned it in this book, but we haven't mentioned it yet tonight, a great Western of a very different order, but certainly dealing with mythic material, is My Darling Clementine.
My Darling Clementine.
Which
yeah,
I loved as a film.
That's an amazing film. And, it, you know, as with regard to what the caller was saying, it's a kind of an unusual question about why the gunfight at the OK Corral was remade so many times. I mean, the story of a kind of dissolute Easterner who's dying of tuberculosis.
Doc Holliday.
Doc Holliday, who comes west as a kind of figure of the exhaustion and sort of moral emptiness of the East, who tries for one more stab at life in the West and fails, you know, but has this one glorious moment where he helps Wyatt Earp defeat the Clanton brothers at the gunfight.
You know, one reason they may have made it again and again is that Wyatt Earp was then hanging around Hollywood for the last 15 years of his life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, partly. But there's some kind of attraction to this notion of, as I say, something like, part of the American myth is that we're the new beginning of Europe. And in America, we have the same kind of need for the same sort of myth. The West is the new beginning of the East. Uh-huh. And Doc Holliday represents a kind of spiritual exhaustion in the West that has one more chance at a kind of glorious new beginning by helping Wyatt Earp rid the country of the Klan and sacrificing himself.
And it was the best thing that Victor Mature ever did.
It's incredible.
Great role.
Incredible performance.
And Henry Fonda as Wyatt Earp.
That's one of my favorite scenes in Westerns when Wyatt Earp, there's a scene in it when they're building a church,
yeah.
and it's a kind of image of the new America. The actual America rising out of the prairies.
You've got some of the stills of that scene in the book.
It's unbelievable. And then there's a dance in which Henry Fonda, who is a man of the West, not a dancer, it's a kind of figure for how will this man fit into civilized life? How will he not just be a cowpuncher? And the image that's so beautiful and touching is dancing with Clementine.
Sort of a stiff waltz.
Very, very stiff, but charmingly kind of naive and awkward in a way that perfectly figures this kind of beginning that they're talking about, a very crude, primitive society, but one with aspirations towards the civility of dance.
Excellently perceived. You're quite right. We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and good evening to Jim.
Hi, everybody. Another great topic. I wanted to make a book reservation and then ask a book recommendation, sorry about that, and then ask a question about a movie. And one was, the book was Celluloid Indians by Jacqueline Kilpatrick. It's about the how Indians have been shown in movies. And it's, you know, similar, you know, when the wagons have been circled and the Indians are attacking, they show the guys, you know, holding guns to the women's head in case they're going to be captured. They would be better killed than captured by the Indians. The two movies, I was reading it's the 50th anniversary of Cinerama, and the article I was reading was How the West Was Won. And, you know, it's this, I think it's like a 4 or 5 hour pageant of the expansion of the U.S. across to the West. And seeing it as a child, I loved it. And reading about it now, it just seems kind of insipid and sort of the WASP version of the West. And I don't know if you've seen that or had a comment about that. And if you don't have much on that, if you've seen Dead Man with Johnny Depp.
Yeah, it's a great movie, Dead Man. I yield to no one in my admiration for that movie. But on the larger point you're making, there are two kinds of Westerns. There are Westerns that, I mean, among other, many other kinds, but in terms of your point, there are Westerns that try to portray themselves as historically accurate about the West, and they just fail. They're cliched, banal, as you say, insipid, and often this stereotypical to the point where they're just unwatchable. But the Westerns I'm interested in are not pretending to be historically accurate. I mean, a man can shoot another man with a pistol from 1870 at 200 yards. Somebody can fire three shots in Stagecoach and kill men at 150 yards. These are more like what we think of as Achilles being capable of in the Iliad or something. They're not supposed to be historically accurate, and they make no pretension to accurately displaying the real nature of the war against the Indians. They are a different genre altogether than historical docudramas about the conquest of the West and the campaign of extermination against the Native Americans. So I agree with you that there are many, many Westerns that purport to be historical docudramas and are just terrible and unwatchable. But the ones I'm interested in have a much different ambition, and their historical inaccuracy is not really to the point any more than the historical implausibility of the Iliad is to the point.
Our thanks to the caller.
Thanks.
What is that film? I'm blocking on the name of the actor. He's a very well-known actor. Done, I guess, also some 20 years ago. He himself directed it. He's an army guy out in the West solo on some sort of observation post, and he gets involved with the local Indians and becomes essentially a member of the tribe.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't place
it. It's Kevin Costner's film.
Oh, yeah, Dances with Wolves.
Yeah.
I have no settled view on that movie, made no real impression on
it. No?
No.
I found it quite affecting.
It won the Oscar.
Quite beautiful.
Yeah, it won Best Actor. I'm sort of allergic to Kevin Costner. I just, some kind of personal, he just offends me by being.
I wonder.
I don't know why. I can't really defend that.
But. Must be because of the earlier film, which he has evolved into a human being with gills.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty bad film. Yeah,
Waterworld.
Waterworld, that's right. Yeah, good.
We pause the last round of commercials and then directly back to your calls.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And before we go back to the phones, another brief commercial for ourselves. I'm talking about our website, where you find literally hundreds of podcasts. On the first page, some 40 or so podcasts, both all the recent programs and then lots of ones which we classify as classic Extension 720. But we keep bringing new ones up on the first page. Just today, we've added one with Anthony Bourdain. You know that name. He's the original chef who's now become a great international diner, and he's got a a series, a television series, in which he runs around the world dining and having fun. But a very interesting man. He wrote an expose about what really happens in restaurants. And this is a conversation we had with him probably 15 years ago. In the classics category, there's some we've kept up more or less permanently rather than having rotated them. One with an old and dear friend and a great figure, Carl Sagan. Another with Henry Kissinger. Yet others, Oliver Sacks. One with Wally Phillips, who for many years was the leading man in Chicago radio, and that was done a good 25 years ago when I was just beginning to do this thing. Many other things with great scholars, one on great speeches in history, in which we play some of those speeches and otherwise have actors do them. A visit with an old dear friend of mine, James the Amazing Randi, the magician who has been showing up psychic frauds for many years, with General Vernon Walters, a most unusual person, with a great local literary figure, Joseph Epstein, and his book on snobbery, which we talked about some years ago. You get to all of that by just going to wgnradio.com/extension720. And I just run across some of the ones that you find on the first page where you have links that say more podcasts and so on. When you hit on those links, you'll find literally hundreds more. And you can just download and listen at your leisure or stream them and listen directly. Again, you get to that by going to wgnradio.com/extension720. We go quickly back to the phones, and next up is Mike. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I could not disagree with your guest more. You know, I can't believe how people are trying to redo, rewrite what happened in the movie. I don't think John Wayne was a racist at all. He just saw his brother, his brother's wife, two of his nieces killed, a couple of them raped. I mean, this man didn't have the old neighborhood to go back to. All he had, you know, for a home was his brother's family, and they were taken away from him. I think this was the beginning of America's liberals' blame the victim campaign. I mean, no one seems to blame the Indians, the savages, for their part in this travesty. And to take a man that's, you know, a character that's uneducated, living in the Old West where it was kill or be killed, and try to put, you know, modern morals to him that he has to partake of, he's responsible for, I think is idiotic.
Well, I think there are a couple of things one has to say. One is Wayne, before the massacre, is already extremely uncomfortable with Jeffrey Hunter simply sitting at the same table as he is.
But he didn't kill him, so he can't be a racist because Jeffrey Hunter had Indian blood, and Jeffrey Hunter's squaw that follows him in the movie, he didn't kill her either.
Yeah, but there's a kind of humiliation of her, which they're very, in a way, embarrassed about when they find her dead later. I mean, they push her down, they laugh at her. And I think in terms of the Indians, the movie tries very hard to balance the hatred that John Wayne feels for the Indians. I did say it's too simplistic to say he's simply a biological racist, that this is the product of war. But what the movie makes clear is that that's also true from the Indian side. You learn that all of Scar's sons have been killed by white people. And there's an incredibly powerful scene where they're shot. Their faces are very close together. And you see that Scar, in a way that's quite striking, has blue eyes. He's played by a German actor, actually, a man named Harry Brandon. And it's clear that he has been, in some way or another, the product of a mixed race marriage or a paternity. And they both trade jibes about how well each one speaks the other's language. So there's actually an attempt to suggest that the racism on both sides is not simply a matter of beliefs that they have arbitrarily, but are the product of the long experience of the Indian Wars. And so what I tried to say was it would be simplistic to just think the man is by chance has these views. But you always have to remember he's trying to track down – he's not trying to kill the people who killed his wife. He's trying to track down an 11-year-old girl and shoot her to death in cold-blooded murder. I mean, you can't, in a way, excuse the brutality of the central feature of the plot of the movie.
Here is a quick email which asks simply, I wonder what the guest thinks of McCabe and Mrs. Miller, one of my favorite Western movies of all time.
It's a tremendous movie, but it's almost like an ironic
Robert Altman, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's like an ironic comment on Westerns rather than an actual kind of traditional Western plot. It's an ironic Western and done with a very deft and subtle kind of irony. I think it's a fantastic film.
Add five or six more to the list, to the ones we've already talked about. What are the other very significant Western films dealing with the mythology and adding to it or somehow using it in a way that is even of political or at least of historical significance?
Well, I mean, there are certainly many more films by Ford. Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
The cavalry epics in general.
There are a lot of people who like Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo that think that's a really classic Western. I've never been able to get into them. Maybe it's Ricky Nelson or Dean Martin or something. It's just something about the characters just sets me off. But the one thing I would like to make a plug for are Westerns that are slightly different from the more epic kind of Westerns, which happen somewhat later in the genre. They're called now something like psychological Westerns. The greatest director is Anthony Mann, who made most of his Westerns with Jimmy Stewart, The Man from Laramie, Winchester 73. These are Westerns that are much more focused on the internal turmoil of somebody caught between this civilized and primitive world and what it does to somebody internally. And then there's a director that's even more less well-known than Bud Bedeker, who made most of his Westerns with Randolph Scott. And they're very spare, kind of elegant movies that are about extremely simple issues, mostly around the theme of masculinity, about what happens to the martial virtues of heroic warrior types when they have to be civilized, what that does to them, what the tensions are like, and what the persistence of the appeal of these virtues has in what are nevertheless domestic Pacific societies. So the two I'd make the greatest plug for are Anthony Mann and Bud Bedeker as really fantastic directors.
And we'll work in a few more quick calls in the limited time available. Next up is Mark. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milton. Just a question to Mr. Pippin. If you would go back a little bit, please, on the influence of because I think probably some of the earliest silent films were all Westerns,
yeah. And
such actors as Bronco Billy Anderson and whatnot.
Yeah, that's a good point. For a full history of the Western, you'd have to go back to 1903. When what is generally accepted as the first Western, The Great Train Robbery, was made. And the appeal of Westerns early on was just because the visual nature of Westerns is so spectacular. You have unbelievable scenery, great open spaces, tremendous vistas, and then you have a plot that often centers around enormous violence. So the cinematic appeal of Westerns, of moving pictures, is an independent part of the story and one that would have to be added before you could have an adequate history. You're right.
Well, thanks to the caller. We want to move quickly. Here's the next. Hello, you're on the air. This being Anne, I believe.
Yes, hi, Milt. Just wanted to mention two Westerns that meant a lot to me. One is, and I don't recall the title, is Gail Russell and John Wayne. And I believe Gail Russell is a Quaker. And John Wayne somehow gets involved with their family. And also Lonesome Dove, which was a multi-part TV series.
That was a great – I remember that one very well. The other one I can't quite bring to mind, but any –
It's also set in Monument Valley. It may well be a Ford film, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
John Quaylen is in it.
Yeah. Well, as we were talking during the break, anytime you're confused about this, imdb.com, internationalmoviedatabase.com, comes right up. It's a great aid for those of us whose memories seem to be losing their hold.
Thank you. And one other movie was The Ballad of Cable Hogue, which was Sam Peckinpah movie, which is very different than his other movies, I think.
Yeah. It's not like The Wild Bunch or Ride the High Country. That's true.
Thank you, ma'am. And we end with Mary, who raises a very different kind of Western. Good evening.
Hi there. I don't want to bring this wonderful program down by mentioning like Blazing Saddles.
But it's an interesting point.
Pardon me?
It's an interesting contribution.
Yeah, if you have a genre in Hollywood, you know, a romantic comedy or a Western or a war film or a science fiction film, they're ripe for comedy. And Mel Brooks also did a great one on science fiction movies. I forget the name of it now, but it's Spaceballs, I think is the name of it. Yeah. So anytime you have genre conventions, it's kind of funny to stick comic situations inside the convention. That's certainly a great one, Blazing Saddle.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call. We just got about a minute and a half left. How do your colleagues take to your doing this kind of work rather than yet another book on Nietzsche?
Well, you know, something has to be said about sort of the status of this film. When I was in college and graduate school, say in the 1960s and 1970s, it was prior to the age when there were film studies departments. And I think all of us who are of that generation remember that films were the great kind of intellectual conversation piece. Everybody saw films, and everybody had something to say about them. They were not specialized knowledge. It wasn't like philosophy or literary criticism or music criticism, where you were supposed to have some sort of specialized knowledge. There was just a great currency in discussions of very serious issues, often philosophical issues, that could be raised by people just simply talking about films. It's not the case that after the 60s and 70s that many good films were being made anymore, but it is a way of raising issues that don't necessarily presuppose a technical vocabulary or specialized knowledge, but which are nevertheless fundamental issues that concern every thoughtful human being. And it's just an enormously good vocabulary for talking about things that are of concern to me.
And you've done it very successfully and very persuasively. The book that we've been drawing from by Robert Pippin is Hollywood Westerns and American Myth. And Yale University Press are the publishers. We will be back again on Sunday night when we're doing our more or less annual restaurant review with three of the leading restaurateurs in town, foremost among them Penny Pollock, who runs the dining section for Chicago Magazine. And with that, we will close down with thanks again to Robert Pippin. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night to all.